You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, Stephen Hawking says that black holes may be doors to parallel universes, and spooky action at a distance is confirmed in the lab.
So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years we see one of the authors of this paper on a Nobel Prize. I think it's that exciting.
Igor Pakovsky explains how time dilation could turn the fuzzy quantum realm into the classical world we see around us.
From that, we found that this slowing down of these vibrations due to time dilation actually affects the quantum nature of the overall molecule.
How to save the world in 5 simple steps, according to Sabine Hossenfelder.
What can I say? You know, just give me 15 million euro and I would save the world. I don't think that's a large price tag.
Inventing the new field of quantum thermodynamics with Jonathan Oppenheim.
And people are constructing little nanorobots, for example, that can extract work. Or in the human body, we are thinking of things as operating thermodynamically, and they're often very small systems.
And making movies about physics with filmmaker Dagomir Kashlakovsky.
I hope that it was interesting for some people who, you know, are not scientists or they don't have any inclination, and then they see that there are some really interesting, paradoxical things happening in science.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
So here we are, back with another physics podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. We hope you've been having a good summer, free from any horrible accidents, like, you know, slipping into a black hole.
Is slipping into a black hole something that's likely to happen, Brendan?
I have nightmares about it constantly.
Okay, but also, if someone had been swallowed by a black hole, how would they be able to listen to the podcast?
Aha! You may think that it's impossible to escape from the grip of one of these cosmic monsters if you're unlucky enough to fall in. But actually, in August, Stephen Hawking announced that he has found a way out.
Okay, we should say here, before you get too excited, that we don't really know what exactly Hawking's new theory is. He trailed it at a black hole meeting in Stockholm, and his talk made headlines around the world. So we thought we'd better mention it here in this news roundup.
FQXI member Sabine Hossenfelder was at that meeting, and she wrote about the talk on her blog Back Reaction, which we're linking to on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. Go there for more technical details. From her post and a few other sources, this is what we've gathered. This is Hawking's attempt to solve a paradox that he himself discovered in the 70s. He had calculated that over time, black holes gradually emit radiation. He had calculated that over time, black holes gradually emit radiation until eventually they evaporate. But if that's so, then what happens to the information about the things that have been swallowed by the black hole? Quantum theory tells us that information cannot be lost from the universe. So where does it go? Here's what Hawking said at the meeting.
40 years ago, I wrote a paper, Breakdown of Predictability in Gravitational Collapse, in which I claimed there would be loss of predictability of the final state if the black hole evaporated completely. The paper was very controversial. It was rejected by the Physical Review, and accepted only after much argument, and a delay of a year. This is the information paradox. How does the information of the quantum state of the infalling particles re-emerge in the outgoing radiation? This has been an outstanding problem in theoretical physics for the last 40 years. Despite a large number of papers, no satisfactory resolution has been advanced. I propose that the information is stored, not in the interior of the black hole as one might expect, but on its boundary, the event horizon, in the form of super translations of the horizon.
We're also putting a link to the video of the talk from which I pulled that sound clip on the podcast page. Hawking's solution, as you heard, involves the idea that a kind of hologram of what falls inside the 3D black hole exists on the event horizon in 2D. This is an idea that comes from string theory.
Hawking's new idea, developed with Malcolm Perry of Cambridge University and FQXI's Andrew Strominger at Harvard, is that Hawking radiation emitted from the black hole can carry that 2D information away from the event horizon. But it ends up in what he calls a chaotic and useless form, which is how I feel about myself some days. He also mentioned something at a public talk about how if the black hole is rotating, information could escape into a parallel universe.
That's all we know about that, to be honest. But we're linking to a nice accessible roundup of the story by Jacob Aaron at New Scientist on the podcast page, along with a profile of Strominger by reporter Sophie Hebden, called The Cosmic Hologram, that explains more about this idea from string theory that there are 2D copies of the 3D world at the edge of the universe.
Hawking has also promised that he'll release a paper soon that explains his ideas in more detail, so we'll keep you posted.
Meanwhile, there was another major announcement made at the end of August. The spooky nature of quantum mechanics was confirmed in the strictest experiment yet, carried out in the Netherlands. Here, we're talking about entanglement, the quantum phenomenon that allows distant particles to become twinned in such a way that carrying out a measurement on one immediately influences its partner.
This is what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And he hated it. Many experiments seem to have confirmed that this effect is real over the years, but they always had slight loopholes that meant you couldn't quite rule out the less spooky interpretation of the results favored by Einstein. The new test at Delft, which is known as a Bell test, after the physicist John Bell who came up with the idea, has closed the two major loopholes plaguing previous experiments for the first time. So how big a deal is this?
Well, the authors of the paper can't speak directly to the media about it because their paper is under review. But I asked FQXI member Matt Liefer to explain its significance.
There hasn't been a Nobel Prize for Bell's theorem yet. I think closing these loopholes makes it more likely that there will be. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years we see one of the authors of this paper, along with some of the older experiments like Espe and people like that, on a Nobel Prize. I think it's that exciting. I mean, one thing I would say, though, is that if we go past just the foundational implications and talk about practical things, then doing a loophole-free Bell experiment is an important milestone along the way to getting practical what's called device-independent quantum cryptography. I say it's a milestone because if you look at this experiment, it has, if you wanted to use it for that kind of purpose, it would have truly atrocious bandwidth because they managed to get 245 good runs of the experiments in over a time period of 9 days. Whereas if you want to use this practically, you know, you want to be generating sort of thousands of secret key bits per minute or so. So there's a long way to go as far as that's concerned, but it's an important milestone because it allows us to start thinking about doing cryptography, which really relies on very, very few assumptions about the physics. And we've had, you know, quantum key distributions hacked in ways like that in recent years. You know, there have been stories about that. Whereas if you move to this device independent scheme, then it really absolutely does not matter whatsoever what's going on with, you know, the system becomes much more like a black box. Then if you observe a violation of Bell inequality, then you know that you have security. You know that you can generate secure key from that, for example.
That was Matt Liefer, who definitely thinks the experiment is important. I've explained more about the test in a blog post, linked to on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, including why this test is important for shoring up security in quantum cryptography. I'm also linking to an article that I wrote about this for Nature, which quotes Liefer and FQXI's Anton Zeilinger and Nicolas Gisin.
Now, that quantum experiment in Delft might have upset Einstein by proving that the world is truly spooky. But he may now get his revenge. One of the biggest puzzles facing physicists is why we don't see quantum effects around us in the everyday world. Electrons can be in two places at once, according to quantum mechanics. Well, I'm just stuck here, recording this podcast, when I'd far rather be simultaneously lying on a beach in Puerto Rico.
Ah, yes. So what is it that causes the quantum world to change into being the boring classical world we see around us? The answer could be to do with Einstein's theory of relativity. Igor Pekovsky at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and FQXI's Czeslaw Bruckner and others have been investigating whether a phenomenon identified by Einstein, time dilation, could be destroying fragile quantum states. Reporter Corinne Pikema spoke with Pekovsky to find out more.
For many decades now, physicists have been grappling with a big fundamental question. Why does the quantum world look so very different from the day-to-day world that we experience? Quantum mechanics describes the behavior of subatomic particles with great precision and has been proven time and again experimentally. Yet its laws are more than a little confusing to most of us. The implications of one of the most widely known quantum phenomena, superposition, seems particularly hard to imagine. According to this law, a particle can behave like a wave, which theoretically means that it can be in multiple places at one time. Though we might wish we could be in several states or places at once occasionally, we don't observe this kind of behavior outside of the realm of particle physics. So something must be happening at the transition between the quantum and classical worlds that destroys such quantum states. Einstein's extremely influential theory of general relativity, which is celebrating its centenary this year, might once again hold the key to uncovering a mystery. According to Igor Pekovsky and his colleagues in Vienna and Queensland, the slowing of time near massive objects might be the cause of the destruction of quantum phenomena. I spoke with Pekovsky, who currently works as a postdoctoral researcher at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge in Massachusetts, on Skype. To help understand the new findings, I asked him to begin by explaining gravity according to Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Before Einstein, our view of gravity was dominated by Newton's theory. And basically, Newton's theory of gravity is that gravity is something like a force between different particles or systems. And this force becomes stronger the more massive the systems are. So planets attract each other and apple falls on Earth and so forth. Einstein realized that this is not the full story, actually. So he was thinking about just very conceptual problems with such Newtonian theory. And at some point, he realized that gravity is somewhat something different than just simply a force. And then finally, when he formulated the theory of relativity, general theory of relativity, it really explains gravity as a geometric theory. Geometric in the sense that the whole space in which we live in is actually changed whenever we put a massive object inside of it. So masses don't simply attract each other as a Newtonian theory, but rather they really bend the space around them such that other masses kind of feel this kind of bending, other systems, and then they follow this kind of bent space.
An easy way to visualize what this bending of space looks like is to imagine a jeu de boule ball on a thin rubber sheet. Around the ball, the sheet is curved and stretched a little, and when we add a lighter object, say a marble, the curvature of the sheet means that the marble falls towards the jeu de boule ball. But this is not the full story. Einstein described gravity as a bending of space and time.
The bending of time is a little harder to visualize, but it's in some sense exactly the same. The Earth bends the time flow around it, so it alters a little bit this kind of notion we have about how quickly time progresses. And so what happens is that if you're closer to the Earth, there is more of this type of bending. And so time is a bit more stretched in some sense. What we mean by that is really that if you compare different clocks, one clock which is closer to Earth and one clock which is further away, they will not go at the same rate. And the one closer to Earth will actually go a bit slower. And that's true about anything. It's not just true about a physical clock that we can measure, but it's really true about any system which is evolving in time, like our heartbeat or any kind of dynamics. This is why we really speak about bending of time itself and not just simply a change of our physics of clocks.
Altered time flow as a result of massive objects is called time dilation. The practical implications of the slowing of time near massive objects is that people who live at higher altitudes will age a little more quickly than someone who lives at sea level. Bukowski and his colleagues think that this slowing of time closer to Earth might be what destroys the fragile quantum states. But first, Bukowski sets out the issue of the quantum to classical transition.
This kind of so-called quantum to classical transition by itself has nothing to do with gravity, but it's more of a conceptual question about quantum theory itself. Now, when we say quantum theory, what we really mean are laws of nature which were discovered about 100 years ago, that describe the smallest particles that we know. People developed a full framework, a full understanding of what's going on, which was then later called quantum mechanics. Everything we knew about physics before quantum theory is what we call classical physics today. And so it's different, for example, in the quantum world. So according to quantum laws, there can be very seemingly counterintuitive behavior. One example is the so-called superposition principle, where a particle can, for example, not just be in a definite state, but it can also be in a so-called quantum superposition of both. In other words, some people also say this is the wave-particle duality, that the particle sometimes behaves like a wave, sometimes like a particle. So all of these words are just grounded in quantum theory that predicts a much more rich behavior, a much more unusual kind of physical laws than what we experience in our everyday life. This mismatch between what we experience in our everyday life and how the laws, fundamental laws of nature are at the small scales, is what we call this quantum to classical transition. In some sense, we need to understand how can it be that we don't see this strange behavior on very large scales, so in our macroscopic everyday world, but we see them all the time in experiments for very small particles. So somehow these kind of some quantum behavior is lost as systems become bigger and bigger.
Quantum phenomena are extremely fragile and can be destroyed by interaction with the environment.
This is called decoherence in everyday literature. And there's many models of decoherence. Usually it's some kind of interaction of a particle that you're interested in with something else, which is really something that's outside of the particle. You just can't really control it, and it just happens to interact with the system. And what we found in our work is something of that sort. So it's also decoherence, but it's induced by this Einsteinian theory of relativity. It's induced by time dilation. So what we found is that if you build up a particle of many individual constituents, then what happens is that all these constituents are actually evolving in time by themselves. So for example, one can think of these constituents as being thermally vibrating. So if you have a big molecule, this molecule is never exactly at rest, but it consists of many individual atoms, and all these atoms are just vibrating all the time at very small scales, so they're just jiggling a little bit. This usually is of no big relevance, but we know this is the case. This is what we call when a system has a certain temperature. But so what we found is that this kind of vibration, which is induced by temperature or anything else, is affected by time dilation in the presence of Earth's gravitational field. From that, we found that this slowing down of these vibrations due to time dilation actually affects the quantum nature of the overall molecule or a composite system. So it's a little bit of a logical chain here. But finally, what we find is that if you place some kind of composite system, so a particle which consists of other particles inside of it, if you place that in some gravitational field, it is exceedingly hard to sustain the quantum coherence of this particle because of time dilation.
This work opens up numerous avenues for highly valuable experimental exploration.
I'm pretty sure in the next couple of decades there will be experiments that really test this kind of interplay of quantum theory and non-Newtonian gravity. The one experiment we suggested in the paper was to really take a very complex molecule and put it in a superposition of something like micrometers and then really see this decoherence. This is a little bit similar to experiments that are already being performed in Vienna as well in the group of Markus Arndt. They take very, very big molecules and put them in superposition. Now, the molecules that are needed to see this effect we're describing are still much bigger than what they can do in Vienna. But it's a possible path that we describe, and I'm sure eventually maybe it could be possible that this should work out. Another way is, I said in the beginning that this effect really stems from time dilation, meaning that any clock is affected, so clocks really learn slower. So one could also think of an experiment, instead of taking a complex molecule, one just takes a single atom, and inside of it one uses internal states as clock degrees of freedom. So usually, anyway, people use atomic clocks as very precise clocks. And if one combines that with the technology of creating quantum superpositions at different heights, which people also do in so-called atomic fountains, then this type of effect, a very similar effect, should also kick in and maybe could be visible in such experiments as well.
Once such experiments are a reality, physicists can start to shed more light on the major theories. But Pekovsky doesn't expect we'll need to drastically rethink what we know today.
These kind of experiments help us to at least shed a little bit of light on the fundamental concepts that come into both theories, and at the very least just to show us that they both can come together and nothing strange happens. So in the most likely scenario, experiments, when they probe these kind of phenomena, should see something, well, as we describe, for example, or there's other ideas of other people as well, but really something that follows from our understanding of physics today. So I would expect there wouldn't be any clash or any kind of surprising things happening outside of physics as we know it. But having said that, this is really a regime where we have absolutely no experiments so far at all. So actually probing that really, I think, helps us, even if it just confirms that the mathematics is fine, but it really helps us to somehow understand a little better how the different concepts from these two really seemingly different theories come together a little bit.
Understanding the quantum to classical transition has long been very difficult. Now, slowly but surely, theoretical physicists like Pekovsky and his colleagues are starting to pinpoint to mechanisms that cause quantum properties to break down in larger objects. Their findings can now be exploited in experiments, and though the experimental setups might not yet seem straightforward to implement, Pekovsky is optimistic about the future.
What I just want to stress as well is that this kind of phenomena where time dilation comes into this quantum coherence really may show in different experimental settings. All these experiments are pretty hard to do, but I think they are reasonable to at least expect that they will be realistic maybe in the coming years or decades. So I'm pretty sure that something like that should be possible, and I'm excited to just explore what other types of experiments one could do.
Thank you to Igor Pekovsky for chatting with Corinne Pikema. Regular listeners will remember that on the last podcast, Corinne interviewed Keith Schwab about his investigation of similar effects in the lab. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to that interview and her profile of Schwab, which includes Pekovsky too.
Now, someone else who is very interested in combining quantum mechanics and gravity is FQXI member Sabina Hossenfelder, a physicist at the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics. We mentioned her earlier because she blogged about Hawking's new ideas. Brendan actually met up with Hossenfelder a few weeks ago at the New Directions meeting in Washington, D.C., where you talked about
how to save the world.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a bigger topic than I was expecting. But Hossenfelder is a good person to ask, since she won last year's FQXI essay contest, which asked about how humanity should steer the future. So, perhaps now is a good time to catch up with her and find out how her 5-step program to rescue civilization is going.
Sabina Hossenfelder is a physicist at the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics in Stockholm, Sweden. In 2014, she won the FQXI essay contest, which asked, how should humanity steer the future? Her essay combined a visionary imagination with realistic practicality to propose a five-step plan for saving humanity. Hossenfelder won second prize in FQXI's 2009 contest by arguing that we could never really answer the contest question. This time, she took a similar cosmic view and argued that humanity can't currently follow through any suggested courses of action because of the overwhelming complexity of choosing the action and of making that action happen. If realized, her plan would make complex decision-making cheaper and easier. However, she says, the procedure won't be cheap or easy itself at first. I met up with Hossenfelder in Washington, D.C. this past April and asked her if anything had happened in the year since she wrote her essay.
Not that I know of.
Why do you think that is?
Well, who would do it? It's like, I mean, somebody has to do it. From nothing comes nothing. So it seems unlikely somebody would just go and read the essay and do what I told them. Mm-hmm. It would be nice, but I think I'm too realistic to believe that.
Hossenfelder's solution for steering humanity uses gamification. That's the modern motivational technique that turns everything from weight loss to social interaction into a game. As the essay explains, gamification helps us steer through a complex process by connecting the outcome of any action with an immediate reward that tells us how well our action met our goals. Hossenfelder's essay explains that gamification of humanity has two ingredients. First, individual players create their own games to help them realize their personal goals and priorities. Second, some form of oversight organization, what I think of as a game master, studies the data coming from the gameplay of all the players. The game master looks at how the individual gameplay affects the direction of the network as a whole. The game master then feeds their findings back to the players to affect the gameplay at the individual level. This feedback loop connects individual gameplay with the evolution of the larger network of gamers. To steer humanity, then, here are the essay's five steps. In step one, scientists develop their own individual maps of priorities for research. Hossenfelder claims this is a good first step because it is already doable with existing technology and the infrastructure of the academic system. In step two, we set up the game master and turn on the feedback loop that allows the scientist network to evolve. In step three, we use the lessons we learned from running steps one and two, and create individual games for everyone. In step four, we set up the game master feedback loop for the social system. And finally, in step five, we upgrade the priority maps into physical brain extensions for maximal efficiency of the process. I asked Hossenfelder, could she estimate how much this plan would cost?
I did sketch a budget for this, and you need a certain group of people. I mean, my proposal was basically it's an interdisciplinary approach that brings together sociology with computer science and with people from other disciplines. So the visualization of this data plays a large role, and then it must be user-friendly and so on and so forth. So you need a certain group of people to work on this. You need equipment, and then you need time. And so all of this takes money, so you can estimate how much it is. But what really drives up the cost is that you need to cover different areas. So you need to have a fairly large group, and that just costs money. What can I say? You know, just give me 15 million euro and I would save the world. I don't think that's a large price tag.
Do you think that, could you start on some smaller part of it?
That was the smallest part. It doesn't really make sense to start with something where you cannot cover all these different things. You see what I mean? And I tried at least twice to apply for some interdisciplinary money, once with the NSF and once with the European Research Council. And it just doesn't work, you know. It comes back saying, well, that I'm not qualified to work on this, which is totally true because I'm applying for the money because I want to hire people to do it, right? So it's just totally pointless. I'm very cynical about all interdisciplinary things for this reason.
How hopeful are you that this project will eventually, that these steps could eventually...
I'm perfectly sure that it will eventually happen. You can take that as a prediction. Okay. The question is how long it will take. Mm-hmm. So, you could start it right now, or you can wait 20, 30, 40, 100 years, and in this time the problems will only get bigger. So the sooner you start trying to address them with developing these tools that I was talking about, the easier it will be to address the problems in a timely manner. The longer you wait, the more difficult it will get and the more money it will eventually cost. As I said, it will not be very optimistic.
Was this something that you had thought of before this actual contest?
Yes, sure. In particular, the last step of the five step was that I said you have to start somewhere. And I said that the logical point to start with is the scientific community. Because if we cannot solve our own problems, then why should anybody believe us that we can solve their problems? And I think that academia right now does have a lot of problems of exactly the type that I outlined, where we are not able to act on these problems because we do not have access to all the relevant information, and even if we had it, it was too much information that we cannot process or do not want to process because it takes too much time. There's always this question of, even if we could do it, would we actually do it, or is it just too costly in terms of time, energy, and so on. So I said that we should start with the scientific community. And this is something that I have been thinking of for a long time. It's just so obvious. Like, if you're a scientist and you look at it, people talk about this all the time, that the community has all these sociological problems. Everybody knows it, mm-hmm. But people just play along. They just say, oh, this is a systemic issue. Okay, good. Which doesn't really solve the problem. But
that was Sabine Hossenfelder, telling Brendan how to solve the world's problems. Her vision, along with that of our 13 other big winners, are compiled in a new volume published by Springer. The book, which can be pre-ordered now and should be available in October, contains updated and expanded versions of the essays that are still available on our site. There's a link for pre-ordering the book on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, and later, we'll be hearing more from Brendan's trip to Washington. So, Brendan, how does the new essay contest volume compare to the others that are on sale, Questioning the Foundations and Eat from Bit or Bit from It?
Well, this one's green, and the others were red and blue.
Well, thank you for that profound insight.
Yes. One thing I can say is that the contributors to the FQXI Springer volume on how humanity should steer the future have shown a lot of ingenuity in trying to imagine the problems civilization may face in the future without having a clear idea about new technologies the coming centuries will have to offer. It's amazing to think just how unimaginably far we've come in the past couple of hundred years. In the 18th century, we had the Industrial Revolution, which built on advances in thermodynamics. That's the science of heat and energy transfer. The 20th century saw the discovery of quantum mechanics, which led to the invention of the transistor and, in turn, today's digital revolution. But what further advances could we make if we were able to combine both of these into one theory of quantum thermodynamics? That's something that FQXI's Jonathan Oppenheim, a quantum physicist at University College London, has been thinking about, as he explained to reporter Colin Stewart.
Physicist Jonathan Oppenheim has recently been awarded a large FQXI grant to explore the relationship between quantum theory and thermodynamics. I went to visit him in his office at University College London, and I started by asking him to tell me more about the research he's doing with the grant money.
So we know what the laws of thermodynamics are, and they're laws which are statistical in nature. So they're valid for very, say, large gases or steam engines. They're valid for large systems or systems composed of many particles. And the question I'm interested in is, are there laws of thermodynamics at the quantum level? So if, rather than trying to look at some average laws for a gas at very large volume, we could imagine looking at just one of those gas molecules and asking, are there laws of thermodynamics which are applicable to that atom which is behaving quantum mechanically? It turned out to be quite surprising, actually, that we were able to find laws of thermodynamics at the quantum scale. And they take on forms which look very similar to the laws of thermodynamics which are applicable to large objects. And so that was quite surprising.
Why is it important to know how individual particles are behaving thermodynamically?
What we're doing at the moment is looking at smaller and smaller objects, and often at colder and colder temperatures. That's what we're doing in understanding the quantum world. We're looking at these sorts of objects in the lab, and people are constructing little nanorobots, for example, that can extract work. Or in the human body, we are thinking of things as operating thermodynamically, and they're often very small systems. They're not large systems, and so that's pushing you to ask these sorts of questions. But I think more interestingly, the laws of thermodynamics are probably the most broadly applicable set of laws we have in physics, because they're somehow independent of the microscopic laws of physics. You know, the second law, for example, which says that the entropy of a closed system has to always increase, or at least that's one way of formulating it. That's a law which is very robust and applies, some people think, regardless of what the laws of physics are. And it gives you an arrow of time, for example, regardless of what the underlying laws of physics are. So the laws of thermodynamics are really applicable to all branches and all areas of physics, and they're somehow more universal, and we can derive them mathematically, and they don't seem to be contingent on the particular universe we happen to be living in. So in some sense, they're maybe the most interesting set of physical laws we have. And so if you're interested in quantum mechanics, as I am, then you push naturally to ask that question, well, do they apply the quantum scale? Let me give an example. So the second law of thermodynamics is often stated by saying that the entropy of a closed system has to increase. So things get more disordered as time goes on. Your room gets messier rather than tidier, or it takes some work in order to clean your room up, whereas getting messier just seems to happen naturally. If we look at a film backwards, we can tell that something funny is going on, because we'll have a broken vase which suddenly becomes more ordered, and we notice that's wrong. That seems to violate the second law of thermodynamics. So the second law is often phrases that the entropy increases. I prefer to think of it as saying that something called the free energy always decreases. And that's true of large gases. And the funny thing is that at the quantum scale, that law still holds. But actually, there's a whole bunch of other free energies which also have to go down. So the ordinary second law tells us that the free energy has to go down. But it turns out that there's all these other free energies, and they all have to go down as well. And what happens is that for very large macroscopic systems, classical systems, all these free energies turn out to be equal to the same ordinary free energy, but for quantum systems, they're all different. That means that there's many second laws for quantum systems, and so there's more restrictions on what a single quantum particle can do.
We normally think of entropy as a measure of disorder. Can a single particle be disordered? If not, what do you mean by the entropy when we talk about a single particle?
Well, you might say that your knowledge of it may have some entropy. So the single particle, you might not know exactly what quantum state it's in. You could imagine a particle with a spin which is pointing up or down, and we might not know whether it's pointing up or down. And so in that sense, we would say that we have some lack of knowledge about the state of the system, and therefore this quantum particle has some entropy. So with a very large gas, there's a sense of order and disorder and how much we know about the gas and how much we don't. But of a single particle, we can also have a lack of knowledge about it, and there can also be an entropy.
Why is it that there are many second laws for quantum particles, but effectively only one for macroscopic particles?
Imagine you're flipping a coin many times. Each coin toss you do is quite unpredictable. You don't know if you're going to get heads or tails. Each individual coin toss is pretty random. I won't be able to tell you much about what's going to happen. But if I do it many times, then I can say a lot about the result of those many coin tosses. For example, I can tell you that roughly half of them will be heads and half of them will be tails. And the chance that you get, for example, all heads or all tails is just never going to happen. And so it turns out that the more coins you flip, the closer you get to a series of coin flips, which are 50% heads, 50% tails. It's almost never going to happen that we're very different from 50% heads, 50% tails. Let's just forget about all those other cases, and let's only look at the ones where we're approximately 50% heads, 50% tails. And that is enough to describe the system completely, pretty much. because everything else happens with such small probability that it almost never happens and you can just ignore it. This is called the law of large numbers, and what it means is that even though each individual coin toss is not very predictable, a large series of coin tosses is very predictable. That predictability is what gives you only 1 second law. Whereas if you're trying to describe what's going to happen to just a few coin tosses, like 3 coins, then there's a lot more variance in what can happen, and so you have to have these additional constraints as to what can happen.
Now that we're beginning to get these thermodynamic rules of quantum particles, are there ways that can be practically applied?
It was more a fundamental question. It's just the question of, are there laws of thermodynamics at the quantum scale? They're meta-theories, right? Quantum mechanics is not as much a theory as a meta-theory. Quantum mechanics describes electromagnetism, it describes the electroweak force, it describes many different forces. And so it's somehow a framework in a particular law of nature. Same with thermodynamics, it's not dependent on the particular law. So I would say that quantum mechanics and thermodynamics are our big frameworks that we have in physics. And you really want to know if you can combine them. That seems a really important question. And so I think that it was from that foundational nature of these two, we have these two big theories, or these two big meta-theories, can we combine them? For me, that was the interesting fundamental question. From a practical level, I think it's definitely the case that we're starting to probe that level. And so one example is, say, for quantum computers, we're trying to cool them in order for them to not have errors. And for all kinds of other quantum technology, you're trying to cool them as much as possible so that they work. And you can ask about the third law of thermodynamics, for example, which says that it takes an infinite number of steps or an infinite time to cool something to absolute zero. And you could ask, well, now that we have the system, how cool can we get it to be if we only have, say, some amount of time? How cool can we get it? And that's an important question fundamentally, I think, and from a practical point of view as well. And it turns out that we can use our techniques to find out, for example, to get a more quantitative and robust and actually prove the third law of thermodynamics and tell us how long it takes to cool a few molecules down to a particular temperature.
You started out working in quantum gravity. Why did you switch?
Well, I moved from one to the other because I don't think the unification of quantum theory and gravity is just a long way off, and it's unclear where we are on that journey, and it seemed to me that this was timely and that these are problems I could actually attack. And I thought equally fundamental and tells us a lot about the world we live in.
That was Jonathan Oppenheim speaking with Colin Stewart. On the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcasts, you'll find a link to Colin's profile of Oppenheim where you can learn more about his research.
Oh, wow, we've covered a lot of quantum-y stuff this edition. The loophole-free experiments that confirm spookiness, the possible connection between time dilation and quantum collapse, and now quantum thermodynamics. I'm a professional science communicator, but that stuff is hard to explain.
One person who has seized that challenge head-on in his own way is quantum physicist Dagomir Kazhlikovsky, an FQXI member who moonlights as a filmmaker. Kazhlikovsky, who is based at the Center for Quantum Technologies in Singapore, was one of our top place winners in the FQXI video contest last year. He's also now working on a new FQXI-sponsored film, oddly enough about Bell's theorem, which is the idea behind the loophole-free experiment we were talking about earlier. I met up with Kazhlikovsky at the New Directions meeting in Washington, D.C., and asked about how growing up in communist Poland affected his career choices, how you go about conveying science through fiction, and if he could only choose movies or physics, which would it be? Dagomir Kazhlikovsky is a Polish physicist at the Center for Quantum Technologies in Singapore and a lifelong filmmaker. His entry, Seeing Without Looking, earned one of 3 top prizes in the first ever FQXI video contest in 2014. Seeing Without Looking has the gritty, grimy look of a 70s-era crime drama and tells the story of a pair of Singapore detectives threatened by an evil mastermind who may or may not have put an extra-sensitive nuclear bomb into a briefcase. The situation is solved thanks to a bank robber turned physicist, played by real-life physicist Flatko Federal, who uses quantum optics to see into the briefcase without technically looking into it. Koshlikovsky's video is clearly the work of a physics expert and an experienced filmmaker. I asked him how he got started making movies.
So my father was a sailor, so he was, you know, traveling a lot. But when he was at home, we used to watch movies together. Yeah. Like, you know, Godfather, you know, all these old good Hollywood movies from 70s. And, you know, that was some kind of bonding experience with my father. And it was fascinating. And I always wanted to make movies. And the first movie I made on, you know, on these old videotapes was when I was 17, around 17. And then it was fascinating, right? I wanted to do it. But at the time, I was living in communist Poland, so I didn't see any perspectives in this direction because all the movies were censored and stuff like that. So I just dropped it. I went to study physics, and then now when the technology is now cheap and accessible, to you can make movies, you know, on a tiny budget, really, as long as you have good ideas. So I decided that maybe it's time to go back, I mean, and to come back to this and start doing this again. No, I actually wanted to go to film school, but as I said, right, it was, there were communist times, so it was difficult to, I didn't see perspectives. I thought that science was a better, was an easy way to do things without being controlled by anybody, because, you know, in this communist country, science was actually, I mean, you could do science. There was no censorship in this respect because there's nothing to censor about science. So I think there was kind of, you know, guarantee of freedom of what you do.
An audience member in the panel discussion at the New Foundations meeting suggested that sometimes the science in a movie or TV show doesn't have to be totally correct. If your goal is just to get people interested. Time travel, for instance, isn't a scientific reality, but it is the reason I got into physics. I asked Koshlikovsky what he thought about this attitude and whether he made compromises in his films.
It's a good question. I think that we should go for certain simplifications just to get people hooked. And if they want to know more, then we should give them opportunity to explore it somehow, right? By either going to a website or reading some article or something like that. But you know, again, it depends which kind of people you want to target, right? If these are people who are geeky or already inclined towards science, then I don't think that you need to, that you have to target them in any special way. So for these people, we can deliver, you know, the message just right, and then they will try to understand it on their own. But, you know, there's a lot of people who maybe don't know that science is interesting, right? Maybe they never had an opportunity to understand that science could be fun and interesting. And these people need some hook, you know, something that will push them in the right direction. And then in this pushing, I mean, this process of pushing them, I think you can maybe not lie, but you can simplify things. Like in this movie that I made, right, the things are simplified, of course. And then on the webpage, when on YouTube, people actually ask very, you know, to the point questions, right? And how is it possible that there are no photons in the suitcase already? Okay, and it's a very good question, right? Because there's a thermal radiation in the suitcase, so there are, of course, some photons there. All right, but so there was certain simplification, but I think that I hope that it was interesting for some people who, you know, are not scientists or they don't have any inclination, and then they see that there are some really interesting paradoxical things happening in science, and they are mysterious, right? So they can, because of that, they can get attracted, maybe. And if they want to know more, they can always, you know, go to Wikipedia and check this bomb tester in more details. So I think that this is one of the strategies, right? Just to get people, just to show them, I know. It's just to show them the mystery, you know? Once you see the mystery, if you have curiosity in you, then you will go and explore it. If you don't have any curiosity, right, then you would just stay at the superficial level and then, okay, at least maybe you enjoyed something, right? That's good enough. I don't think that there's like a silver bullet. There are many approaches and I think we should explore all of them. So one of the guys said that, yeah, we should do what we what we think feels right. And then if it works, good. If it doesn't work, we try another thing. So I think this is the best approach, because I don't think there's some grand strategy that would fit everybody. You just have to try to address different kind of people with different kind of things. It sounds quite actually cliche and obvious, right? That you have to try different approaches. I think that movies is, you know, visual things are always popular. And, you know, as they say, that the picture says thousands words, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. So,
Kavchlikovsky's next film is a documentary funded in part by a mini-grant from FQXI, Three Men and the Bell Theorem. We'll look at the impact of John Bell's famous theorem on the lives of three physicists. He is also hoping to make a follow-up to Seeing Without Looking that will use the context of a zombie invasion to explain quantum teleportation. So far, he also continues to do physics.
Yeah, so the both things are really, you know, interesting, and they give me a kick, right? Doing physics is great. Making movies also something very fascinating. But I think at this moment, as for now, I would just go for the movies, because I've been doing physics for the last, 25 years. So maybe now it would be a good moment to change it. And then I think that, you know, both activities are very creative and require a lot of analytical thinking and, precise thinking. So I don't see a big difference between making movies and doing physics, right? As I said, both are creative processes and both require some discipline. But as I said, I've been doing physics for 25 years, so now maybe I would try to... If I had an option, I would just go for the movies.
Thank you to Dagomir Kashlikovsky for chatting with Brendan. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to some of Kashlikovsky's films and to a profile of his research written by reporter Nicola Jones.
There's also a link back to the podcast special from the New Directions meeting, where you can hear a panel discussion with Sabina Hossenfelder, Dagomir Kashlikovsky, Matt Liefer, and myself on how to convey foundational physics ideas to the public.
So the podcast has been a bit of a reunion for you all. That's all we have time for. So thanks again to all the people that Brendan just mentioned, plus Igor Pekovsky, Corinne Pickema, Jonathan Oppenheim, and Colin Stewart.
If you want to contact us, you can email us at podcast@fqxi.org or reach us on Twitter @FQXI. Thanks, as always, for listening.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm escaping off to a parallel universe.
And I'm going to become a hologram on the edge of a black hole.